Ukrainian forces step up their counteroffensive to reclaim Russian-occupied land, a former U.S. official tells us about a key obstacle they must overcome.
You know, you're starting to get pretty difficult terrain, according to all the videos that I've been watching, of vehicles being abandoned by the Russians, but also just trouble with the Ukrainians trying to advance through mud.
Plus, in Russia, voices critical of the war are being heard on state TV. But a Russian media researcher says that doesn't mean those voices are turning against Vladimir Putin.
They are voicing criticism in a very specific way, basically discussing and critiquing the implementation of the invasion, not the very idea of invasion.
Today is Friday, October 7th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Michael Lippin, filling in for Steve Miller. We start with the situation in Ukraine's southeastern city of Zaporizhia, which is under government control while much of the surrounding region of the same name is occupied by Russia. Ukrainian officials say Russian forces have been carrying out deadly strikes on Zaporizhia city in recent days using missiles and Iranian drones. Reporter Anna Chernikova in Kyiv spoke to me earlier about the casualties from those Russian strikes.
What we know about the latest attack, that yesterday attack took life of at least 11 people. Another 15 are injured. And again, rescue operation is still going on. Today, over the night, in the morning, it was another attack on the city. It was a missile strike. We know that one person is in the hospital. Most of the damages are the infrastructure and residential areas, unfortunately. And today's missile was also targeted to the residential area. In general, the city of Zaporizhia for the moment is this kind of a concentration of internally displaced people and humanitarian organizations. And of course, it is very close to the city of Enerhodar, where the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant is located. And this creates even more danger for this area at this point of time.
Anna, what are you hearing about the Russian and Ukrainian battles going on in the east of the country and in the south?
So two main front lines are now in the east and in the south. Let's start with the south areas. So today, the General Staff of Ukraine confirmed that since the beginning of the month, so for the 7 days, Ukrainian armed forces have liberated 29 settlements in the Kherson region. Previously, before that, the head of the Joint Coordination Press Center of the Defense Forces of Ukraine in the south, Natalia Homenyuk, also reported that Ukrainian forces liberated more than 400 square kilometers of the Kherson region. And this creates this very positive impulse for Ukrainian armed forces. And this was also specified by the U.S. Officials and military officials in particular. U.S. military officials suggest that Ukraine should use this impulse to further advance in the area. So Eastern front line didn't really change much for this past week. We can see that Ukrainian forces managed to almost completely liberate the area of Kharkiv region, and the front line is basically now at the border of the Luhansk region. Ukrainian forces are getting closer to this border, and also they already started to liberate territories in the Luhansk and in the Donetsk regions as well. So we will be waiting for further updates from the Ukrainian general staff and President Zelensky in the nearest future.
Reporter Anna Chernikova in Kyiv, thank you for that update.
Thank you very much.
With Russian President Putin under pressure from the Ukrainian counteroffensive, he has been hinting recently at the possible use of his nuclear arsenal to reverse the situation. President Joe Biden told a group of his supporters Thursday that Putin's threats have brought the world closer to an Armageddon than at any time since the 1960s. As Henry Ridgewell reports from London, Russia's threats and setbacks have thrown the Ukraine war into a critical stage.
Ukrainian troops have broken through Russian lines in the southern region of Kherson, liberating several villages. Kyiv's forces now control settlements some 30 kilometers behind previous front lines. Yaroslav, a Ukrainian soldier fighting close to Kherson, said the mood of the boys, everything has changed compared to what it was before. It has become much better. There is some light at the end of the tunnel, inspired by victories. Ukrainian forces are also consolidating territorial gains in the east. The city of Liman is in ruins, its streets littered with burned-out Russian tanks and dead soldiers. Ukrainian generals say they have advanced 55 kilometers over the past 2 weeks close to Kharkiv. Russian forces are struggling to hold their line. Carolina Hurd is from the Institute for the Study of War in Washington.
We've had reports that the units in northern Kherson Oblast are completely under strength, understaffed, and stretched along a very, very long front line that the Russian troops just do not have the men to fill.
The United States announced an additional $625 million worth of new security assistance for Kyiv this week. Russian President Vladimir Putin last week announced the annexation of four areas of Ukraine, a move rejected by most of the international community. Analysts say the war is entering a critical moment. Charles Kupchan is from the Council on Foreign Relations.
It's becoming, in some ways, make or break for Putin. His ability to survive depends on some level by saying, I've succeeded in defending the Russian homeland and expanding it. Where this goes, nobody knows, but it's safe to say that this probably is the most perilous moment for Mr. Putin since he took power about 20 years ago.
Putin has said he will use any means necessary to defend Russia, raising fears he could use so-called tactical nuclear weapons. James Acton is from the Nuclear Policy Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Stuff is trending very badly for Russia. Now, I don't know how bad it has to be before Russia would consider using nuclear weapons in a very serious way. I'm not even sure Putin knows in his own mind how bad this would have to be for him to use nuclear weapons.
For now, Russia is trying to turn the tide with conventional forces. The Defense Ministry said this week over 200,000 men have already been drafted into the armed forces since a partial mobilization was announced 2 weeks ago. Again, Carolina Hurd of the Institute for the Study of War.
These forces are unlikely to provide any sort of additional defensive capabilities or offensive capabilities in the short run. And in the long run, these troops are unlikely to be well-trained or necessarily highly motivated.
Russian forces continue to launch shells and missiles into Ukrainian-held territory, often into civilian areas. This convoy of evacuees fleeing the city of Zaporizhia was hit September 30th. Dozens were killed, including many women and children. Moscow did not comment on the attack. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
As Ukrainian forces try to push their counteroffensive further into Russian-occupied territories, they may face tougher conditions on the battlefield. David Asher is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and a former U.S. State Department advisor with expertise in security issues. This is what Asher told VOA about how Ukrainian troops will soon need to shift their tactics.
The terrain, the further they get in, there's more, the road system's a little more advanced, as I understand it, and they're going to have to start thinking about urban warfare. I mean, they've, you know, obviously they've gone through Kharkiv city in part, but they've got more around it to take. And as they start to do this, they're going to start to get into more of an urban combat situation, which is hard to know how easy that will be to prosecute, but it'll be easier once they're in an area where there's roads than where they are sort of caught up in swampland or stuff that, because of the rain season, it's already begun. You know, you're starting to get pretty difficult terrain, according to all the videos that I've been watching of vehicles being abandoned by the Russians, but also just trouble with the Ukrainians trying to advance through mud. But, you know, I think that they're determined to get into some of the more urban terrain, trying to push all the way into Luhansk itself. And obviously they're at sort of the door front to Donetsk. And then of course they're making this progress, which is really surprising, frankly, down in Kherson, you know, where they've defended Mykolaiv and they saved Odessa, and they're closing in on Kherson itself. I mean, you know, it's almost like the Russian line is basically collapsing. And, you know, you see these images of the Russians giving up their T-80 battle tanks. I mean, these are the top line equipment. I mean, it's not the type of stuff that you'd expect people to give up without a fight. But there must be a significant morale issue that is traversing the entire Russian front in the areas that they just declared to be Russian territory through the sham referendum.
The Ukrainians have obviously been benefiting a lot from Western military aid. The U.S. announced this week more military assistance. What is your assessment of the effectiveness and the speed with which this aid is being given to Ukraine?
The effectiveness is high, but the speed of the aid is insufficient. I mean, we've sort of set out a red line internally that we wouldn't try to provoke what Biden termed, you know, World War III over the Ukraine. I understand that, but the sort of creeping support to give Ukraine the ability offensively to take back territory, I think we shouldn't just let it come out slowly or in pieces. I mean, it is increasing every week, it seems, but you know, they've just given four new HIMARS missile systems, which is very important. I think they're about 20 now. But if we're going to do it, we should just give them 20 or 24 to begin with. And I'd give them the longer range missiles to go with it so that we could hit the Russian supply lines and lines of communication from the traditional Russian border into occupied Eastern Ukraine. I mean, I personally just, I think, you know, Putin might be provoked by it. He might say, you know, he can use his nuclear weapons, but I, you know, if he's going to use these, then he'll use them anyway, in my mind. We should provide the tools to the Ukrainians to win back their entire country, including what was lost in 2014, if you ask me.
And why do you think the Biden administration has not provided those stronger weapons to Ukraine faster?
I think it's their assessment that Putin would be willing to counter with unconventional means, you know, most specifically nuclear. But again, that's for him to do that, that's a dangerous path as well. It's sort of, he could be sealing his own fate, and he knows it, because, you know, we could retaliate very swiftly. And I think we have plans to do that. I mean, the Russian Navy and, in the Black Sea could be basically erased if they use a nuclear weapon. That'd be one of the response options I'd recommend. But so to me, we should set out a goal of Ukraine capturing its territory, even going back to 2014, recapturing all of it. And at that level, I think there'll be a time to negotiate. But that's basically something that Putin, you know what, he probably won't accept that. There are some people in Russia, though, that are now even contemplating that. I've heard from some Russian former officials that there is a negotiation that the Russians might be willing to do to keep at least a piece of what they gained in 2014, or keep all of it in exchange for stopping the fight. But that's a very incipient movement from what I'm hearing.
That was David Asher, senior fellow at the Hudson Institute in Washington. Visit voanews.com/flashpoint for more updates on the war throughout the day. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Michael Lippin. Russian commentaries critical of the Russian war effort have been appearing recently on Russian state TV and on Russian news sites. To get an idea of whether these commentaries represent a shift in attitudes by the Russian elite toward the war, I spoke with Maxim Alyukov, a Russian media researcher at King's College London. I started by asking Alyukov what kind of war criticism he is seeing.
Yeah, definitely we've seen some criticism, both on state media, but also on all kinds of pro-Kremlin social media groups and channels on Telegram. I would not say that I would not call them contrarian views, right? Because they are voicing criticism in a very specific way, discussing and critiquing the implementation of the invasion, not the very idea of invasion. So there were some discussions about, you know, poor planning, equipment, failures, and many people are sort of wondering what's happening. And there are these attempts to find scapegoats and shift the blame. So who is in charge of, who is responsible for these failures? And yeah, so it's not exactly a contrarian views. It's just the attempt to explain military failures to the Russian public without criticizing the very idea of the war and invasion Putin.
Why do you think we're not seeing any criticisms of the decision to invade?
Well, because Putin's regime is an authoritarian regime, and I'm pretty sure that there are some people among the elite who do not like this idea, but they're just waiting for something to happen, and for they're basically afraid of voicing criticism. So we know that there are some tensions, there are some leaks, but nobody is ready to oppose Putin himself.
Can you give us a sense of where we are seeing these criticisms being expressed about how the war is going? Are they both on TV and in print and even on radio? Is it everywhere?
Well, when some challenges happen on the ground, it's just a very... So what happened recently with Liman is just very similar to how Russian media reacted to Ukrainian counteroffensive in September, right? So the first at first they just ignore these developments because journalists on main TV channels, on the news, they're just afraid of talking about these issues without Kremlin's instructions. So they need some time to receive instructions on how to explain these events to people. So there is silence. And then step by step, we see some attempts to discuss these issues on political talk shows where there are more sort of authoritative figures such as Vladimir Solovyov, Skabeeva, these more autonomous political figures. And basically, very often we see this in the form so-called dissenting voices. So on the talk shows, they sometimes invite people who used to create this atmosphere of democratic discussion. So they're not exactly opposing, criticizing. They are just here to create the semblance of visibility of a discussion. And very often we hear this criticism on these talk shows first, and then after a while, state media, the news, they also learn how to talk about failures too. And this is not something new, right? So it happened, it has been happening across the past 6 months. We saw very similar discussions in spring, say, right? So when it became clear that Russia is not able to take Ukraine and accomplish Putin's goals in a couple of days or weeks, as he claimed, they started to wonder what's happening, and they started to sort of incorporate these critical voices into these political talk shows. Because otherwise it just seems too unrealistic, the gap between reality and propaganda too huge, and people start wondering what's happening. So you need to somehow incorporate these discussions in order to acknowledge challenges, because otherwise people start wondering what's happening.
We'll have more of my conversation with Maxim Alyukov of King's College London in Monday's program. This year's Nobel Peace Prize was awarded Friday to three recipients. One of them is jailed Belarusian activist Alice Bialyatsky, a founder of Belarus's opposition democracy movement. The other two are human rights groups, Ukraine's Center for Civil Liberties and Russian organization Memorial. Speaking in Oslo, Norwegian Nobel Committee Chair Berit Rice-Andersen explained why Ukraine's Center for Civil Liberties deserved the honor.
After Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February 2022, Center for Civil Liberties has engaged in efforts to identify and document Russian war crimes against the Ukrainian civilian population. In collaboration with international partners, the Center is playing a pioneering role with a view to holding the guilty parties accountable for their crimes.
Shortly after that announcement, VOA's Eastern Europe Bureau Chief Miroslava Gongadze contacted the head of the Center for Civil Liberties, Oleksandra Matvichuk, who shared her reaction to the prize.
This award was, frankly speaking, unexpected for me and for all my team. We think and we are sure that this award is not a recognition of only of our work as Center for Civil Liberties, human rights organization, but also recognition of the general struggle of Ukrainian people for our freedom and for our democratic choice.
We close our program today with a look at the Ukrainian National Women's League of America, the largest Ukrainian women's organization in the U.S., established in 1925. Irina Solomko met with members of the group and found out what they are doing to support their war-torn homeland in this segment narrated by Anna Rice.
Natalie Pavlenko is the head of the Ukrainian National Women's League of America, a charitable and cultural organization that was founded in 1925 when five Ukrainian women's associations in the New York City area united into one.
After World War I, there were lots of social issues and humanitarian needs in the country. So women's organizations decided it was better to work together than separately. That's how Ukrainian Women's League was created.
Their initial goal was to preserve Ukrainian culture. The organization's first large-scale project was participation in the Chicago World's Fair in 1933, when the League hosted a Ukrainian pavilion.
The members got items of cultural heritage from Lviv, brought them to the U.S. and showcased them at the fair.
The unique objects presented at the Chicago World's Fair later became the foundation of the main collection at the Ukrainian Museum in New York, which opened in 1976. There are over 15,000 items in its archives, including clothing and art pieces. Today, the organization has over 1,700 members. In the almost 100 years of its existence, the League now has 65 offices across the nation, one in almost every state. Mariana Kretz, who moved to the U.S. 5 years ago, became a League member last year.
I felt my own value when I joined the League, a value to the society and to the Ukrainian society in particular that can help Ukraine. At the events we organize, all the funds we raise, everything we do to support Ukraine.
Pavlenka says that since the start of the war, the League has focused on raising money for the Ukrainians suffering the most because of the Russian invasion, as well as for humanitarian and medical projects. But that's not all.
We have created a new committee, chose a chairperson, and are working closely with other organizations to constantly put pressure on politicians in Washington. Sending humanitarian aid and raising funds are extremely important, but without help from Washington, it's not enough.
Pavlenka says interest in the Ukrainian Women's League has grown considerably since the start of the war, and she hopes to keep that enthusiasm going even after the war ends. For Irina Solomko in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
That brings us to the end of today's program. There's more VOA coverage of Ukraine 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and on our social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. On behalf of the Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. I'm Michael Lippin. Hope you have a great weekend.
This is the voice of America, Washington, ZTC.